Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
Hello there. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I have a very depressing story for you today. I'm very sorry, but it's an important one to tell because, I mean, you'll find out at the end, but it's kind of an example of persistence and best friends advocating for each other and solving crimes and all of that good stuff.
That doesn't sound depressing at all.
Yeah, but what happened to lead to that was depressing.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, that's what a true
Anyway.
That's what the people are coming here for,
that's
dude.
That's true. It's just heavy, so. Angela Simoda was born on September 19th, 1964 in Alameda, California, making her a Virgo like you, Ash.
Yeah.
She was a student at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and she was social chair of her sorority. October 12th, 1984 started out as a completely ordinary day for 20-year-old Angela. She had just gotten lunch with one of her girlfriends, Anna Kadala, and one of the professors before heading back to Angela's place. They decided it would probably be a good idea to take a power nap so that they would be ready for a fun night ahead. When they woke up, they decided to get dressed and start pre-gaming. Angela decided on a black silk jumpsuit and black heels. Both of the girls were students at SMU in Texas, and it's a pretty typical college town where everything is located pretty close together. Your friends live down the street, bars are walking distance. One of their guy friends, Russell Buchanan, stops by the apartment real quick to say hi to the girls. Then they decide that they should all go back to his place so that he can change his clothes and get ready to go out with them. Angela was going to be the designated driver for the night, so she was planning on having a couple of drinks, but nothing irresponsible. She was planning on waking up really early the next morning so that she could go to a football game. The game was in Waco, which is approximately an hour and a half away from where she lived. So have a couple of drinks, get home at a reasonably early time so that she didn't feel miserable waking up at the crack of dawn the next day. The three friends head to a restaurant called Bennigan's before they hit the first club of the night. They hang out at Studebaker's for a while before going to another nightclub called Rio Room. Angela was drinking, but nothing excessive. They decided to wrap up the evening sometime between 12 and 12:30 a.m. By the time they were getting in the car to head home, Angela was not intoxicated whatsoever, and her friends felt completely comfortable with her driving. Angela dropped off Russell first at his place, which was located just a few minutes from her condo. Anna had been planning on spending the night at Angela's, but decided against it when she heard how early Angela was waking up to head to the football game. On the way to her dorm, Anna realized that she left her curling iron back at Angela's apartment, so they decided to swing by and get it before she got dropped off at home. And that is the last time that Anna saw Angela. Russell Buchanan met Angela early October of 1984. They had mutual friends that introduced them. I believe Angela was friends with his roommate's girlfriend, and it sounded like they just met out like one night at a bar. Mm-hmm. So Angela didn't really know Russell that well, but she called him up the night of the 12th and asked if he wanted to come over for drinks. When he showed up and took one look at the girls, he was probably like, holy crap, I am incredibly underdressed, so I need to change if I'm going to be seen with these ladies. So the three of them go back to his place that he can change. They then head to the Boardwalk Beach Club before heading to Rio Room. Russell and Anna both recalled that Angela had called her boyfriend before going to the Rio Room, asking him to meet them out. He said he couldn't meet up because of work the next morning, that he would arrange for them to get into the Rio Room, it was the members only back room. Mm. And according to an employee at the Rio Room, her boyfriend never made a call to get she and her friends in, but they got in anyways. Angela was the type of girl that knew everyone, so she didn't need to be a member or have a referral to get into some club. Russell recalls that the Rio Room was so packed they couldn't really get drinks, so they remained pretty sober throughout the evening. He said that Angela seemed to know everyone there, and she was being a social butterfly, going from table to table saying hi to everyone. He was more than happy to wrap up the festivities because he was heading to a wedding in Dallas the next morning before he went home to Houston. He believes that they left the clubs around 1 or 1:30 before heading home. Multiple details of both Anna and Russell's stories do not match up. You could argue that a few of those details are benign and easily mistakable, like what restaurants and clubs they went to and what time they left, but in this case, every detail matters. Angela had a boyfriend named Benjamin McCall. She invited Benjamin to go out with she and her friends that night, but he said he couldn't go because he had a construction job early the next day. Ben testified later that they had a very comfortable and relatively conflict-free relationship, that they were both really busy people, but whenever they had free time, they'd spend it together. So Angela was used to his demanding schedule and completely understood when he said he couldn't come out that night. She asked him if there was any way he could get her into a private club that he had a membership to. He claimed to have made the call, but he did not meet them out at any point of the night. At 1:30 a.m. on October 13th, Angela knocked on his door. She said that she just wanted to bug him before heading home for the night. He said the whole tone of the conversation was flirty and teasing, and that they talked for only a few minutes. There was nothing serious, no fighting, and then she left. 15 minutes after leaving his place, she calls him. The first sentence out of her mouth was, "Talk to me." Benjamin recalled later that she seemed nervous and scattered, and everything about this exchange felt strange. During the conversation, he could hear sounds coming from the background. Angela then said, "Oh, the bathroom's down the hall," to someone in the room with her. She quickly explained to her boyfriend that there was a man in her apartment that wanted to use her bathroom and her phone.
Oh my
God. At 1:30 a.m. It's unclear whether or not she had let a strange man into her home or if he had already been there when she arrived. She asked Benjamin if he happened to know if there was a payphone at the nearby convenience store before abruptly ending the conversation by saying, "I'll call you right back." She never called him back. Nothing about this felt right to Benjamin, and he tried getting a hold of her, but she wasn't picking up her phone. Benjamin got dressed and rushed to his truck. He had one of those early generation cell phones that he normally used for his construction jobs when he was on site, so he called his girlfriend one more time in the truck, but once again, she did not respond. During that 8-minute drive, he called her again and again, but she did not answer her phone. Benjamin arrived at her apartment around 2 a.m. and began to beat his fist against her front door. He went around to her back door, but it was locked as well. He's in a full-blown panic at this point, and he rushed to the convenience store that she had mentioned earlier in the phone call. I'm guessing he wanted to see if she was there or had been in there recently, but he didn't have any luck. He saw that her car was in the apartment parking lot, and he just knew something was not right. Benjamin called the police at 2:17 a.m. Police officers Ken Bajenska and Janice Crowther arrived around 20 minutes later and met Benjamin at the locked front door. When they knocked and didn't get a response, they used a key that they had gotten from the condo manager. The two officers entered the condo and they could sense instantly that something was off. There was a single black pump on the floor, and they found it strange that there wasn't a second one close by. The officers went slowly from room to room, but there wasn't any signs of Angela. There were no signs of forced entry. The front door was locked, the back door was deadbolted, and the sliding glass door was also locked and intact. The female police officer entered the second bedroom and found Angela lifeless on her bed. She was on her back and her eyes were open. She was nude and covered in blood. Her legs were hanging off the side of the bed. The other black pump was at the foot of the bed. Angela had several deep chest wounds, 18 stab wounds in total. 8 of those stab wounds were to the heart and 2 to the sternum. This injury requires an extensive amount of aggression and force. According to the case file, the deepest stab wound was 7 inches deep and completely penetrated her heart. Officer Crowther stated that it appeared that her heart had been cut out. It looked as if a single-edged knife had caused the injury. Officers noted that a knife was missing from Angela's knife set, and even after extensive searches, they were never able to locate the murder weapon. Based off that observation, you can assume that the killer showed up empty-handed and used one of Angela's knives to kill her. Whoever had done this was very methodical and wiped down the surfaces that he came in contact with, including Angela's phone. There was blood found in her bedroom as well as her bathroom. It looked as if someone had washed blood off of themselves because there was some blood residue in the bathtub as well as on the shower curtain and light switch. There were absolutely no foreign hairs found on Angela's bedding, clothing, or body. Vaginal swabs revealed that she had had sex or was assaulted very close to the time of death. Technically, there was no way to determine whether or not it was consensual or non-consensual, and there wasn't any injuries to her cervix or vaginal area. Everything about that is pretty atypical for most assaults. There was no sign of damage or bruising on her legs, her vaginal area, face, etc. And most of the time when there is an attack, there will be signs of, defending yourself.
Did you say it's atypical?
Atypical, yeah. But with that being said, there doesn't have to be injuries in order to establish that it was non-consensual. An OBGYN named Sarah Williams stated that she had done hundreds and hundreds of sexual assault examinations, and some were done 1 to 3 hours after the assault took place. Yet she had never seen such a large number of intact sperm or congealed semen inside of a victim. So this means that the police discovered her very quickly after this took place. During the examinations of the semen found at the scene, medical personnel concluded that Angela's attacker was a non-secretor. So these results cleared both her boyfriend Ben and her ex-boyfriend. Russell Buchanan was another top suspect, largely due to the fact that he had been out with her that night. His blood type also happened to match the blood collected from her body. Once they cleared Angela's boyfriend, they did everything in their power to get Russell to confess to the crime. Russell recalled detectives holding up the brutally graphic images of Angela's body and saying, "She dropped you off, you were mad because you wanted to have sex with her. You went down to her apartment, she let you in, you had sex with her, she started to scream, you stabbed her and you stabbed her and stabbed her 18 times. No matter how certain the detectives were, they didn't have any concrete evidence to prove that he had murdered her. So now we're going to introduce Sheila Wysocki into the story. Sheila met Angela Simoda on their very first day at SMU. It wasn't exactly friendship love at first sight because Sheila couldn't stand the guy that Angela was dating. They were new roommates, so I could see how that would drive a wedge between you, especially if there's no like history or foundation there.
Yeah.
But once that relationship ended, they got super close. They were polar opposites in most ways. Angela was academically inclined while Sheila had some learning disabilities and was just trying to make it through. Angela was the life of the party while Sheila was friendly but shy. But they found themselves bonding off of one similarity, and that was that they both did not have fathers in their lives. Sheila said, "Angie had a beautiful smile, the biggest I've ever seen, the type of smile that would light up her whole face. She was very vivacious and friendly and one of the few girls in the computer science and electrical engineering department. She was the triple threat. Great personality, real cute, and smart." Angela eventually moved off campus. They were no longer roommates by the time junior year rolled around, but they stayed very involved in each other's lives. She had been invited to go out with the three friends that night, but she didn't go. On October 13, 1984, she received a call from a friend of theirs named Barbara. She was hysterically crying, and Sheila instantly knew something awful had happened. Barbara said that there had been some sort of accident, and Sheila asked her if Angie was dead. Her life changed forever. She couldn't believe that someone so smart, beautiful, kind, and full of life could now be gone. Sheila went down to the police station to sit down and talk with the detectives. They showed her picture after picture, asking if she knew this person or the next, questioning her about her daily routine and where she did her shopping, every last detail to get an idea of who might have been following and watching her day to day. Sheila quickly picked up the fact that the police believed it was Russell Buchanan that had murdered her. I think there were multiple reasons, but it mostly came down to the fact that he was with her that night and his blood type matched the blood found on her body. At one point, Sheila said that she called the police to tell them that she had a bad feeling about Russell. She didn't know why, but there was something about him that made her uncomfortable. So what did she do? She started conversing with him and she invited him over to dinner.
Oh my God.
Sheila wanted to get a read on this man. When she showed up at a restaurant called August Moon, she generally thought that she was about to eat dinner with a murderer. The police thought he did it, therefore she thought he did it. Everything Russell told her at dinner, he had told to the detectives. His story remained consistent and never changed. After that dinner and taking the lie detector test, he lawyered up. His lawyer was a very well-known attorney named Richard Haynes, nicknamed Racehorse Haynes. And I guess the rumor was, if you hire him, you're guilty. The consensus was Russell is guilty, even though there wasn't any physical evidence that suggested that he was at the scene of the crime. But without concrete evidence, none of the suspects could be charged, and the case went cold. Sheila could not let this go. The death of her best friend was the worst thing that ever happened to her, and it traumatized her to her core. She would regularly meet up with the lead detective at bars to talk about the case. They got so close during this time that she invited him to her wedding in 1988.
Wow.
One day in 2004, 20 years after her best friend's murder, she suddenly saw Angela appear before her while doing her Bible study. She couldn't believe her eyes. Right in front of her was her sweet best friend with her big, beautiful smile. Sheila said that she didn't believe in ghosts, but she knew that this was a sign. At that very moment, she picked up the phone and called the Dallas Police Department. She left a message with the homicide division, but never heard back. She called approximately 700 times without any of her phone calls being returned.
Whoa.
She couldn't believe that she was being blown off by the man that she had worked so closely with over the years that she, like, invited him to her wedding.
Yeah.
The most heartbreaking aspect of it all was it had been 20 years and no one but her had ever called. She could not fathom how a woman could be killed so violently and no one was desperate to find out who did this and why. Sheila could not move on with her life and she knew she had to do something about it. She decided she was going to become a private investigator.
Holy shit.
She's such a badass. When she passed her private investigator exam, she figured the police would be more willing to sit down with her and talk about the case. She was wrong. They couldn't care less. And they were also so sick and tired of her inability to drop it. So they opened the case again.
Whoa.
They're like, this woman won't shut up and she won't go away. So we're doing something about it.
Persistence.
We love it. Because of Sheila and her love and dedication to her best friend, a 20-year-old cold case was reopened. A female detective named Linda Crum was assigned to the case, and she worked tirelessly to learn the ins and outs of the case. One day she called Sheila and stated that she knew Russell Buchanan was the number one suspect, and she had the physical evidence to prove it. She said that not only did she have semen to test, they had DNA from Angela's fingernails as well. This was massive. Oddly enough, the technique of DNA testing to determine a fingerprint was actually discovered the year of Angela's murder, but it didn't enter the legal system until 3 years later in 1987. So even though it was being used, it was in the very beginning stages. DNA testing had obviously made leaps and bounds since then. The police department put in a request to test the results, but unfortunately this stuff takes a shit ton of time. It's not a quick process by any means. The following year in 2009, Sheila received a call that would once again change her life. Linda Crum was on the other end, and she said, "We got him." Sheila expected Russell Buchanan to be the next thing out of her mouth, but she was mistaken. The name that came out of her mouth was one that she had never heard in her life. At the time of Angela's murder, this piece of shit had been on parole while serving a 25-year sentence for aggravated sexual assault and kidnapping.
Yet another example of why
I know
anyone convicted of violent crimes should not be
released. They'll do it again. As if we needed another reason to conclude that this man is, you know, scum of the earth, he was currently serving a life sentence for another crime. Donald Bess was born on September 1st, 1948 in Jefferson County, Arkansas. He had been convicted of two rape cases prior to Angela's case.
Two?
Yeah, two. And when he stood trial, several women, including his ex-wife, accused him of sexually assaulting them. The jurors heard from a woman that he had pled guilty of raping 7 years before killing Angela. Her name was Elizabeth Keg, and she said that after Bess abducted her off of a street in Houston, he told her, "You're a victim of my aggression." He proceeded to rape her at knife point. He had been sentenced to 25 years in prison, but he was paroled. Months later, he murdered Angela. With the DNA evidence and multiple women testifying with similar stories, Donald Bess didn't stand a chance. It took the jury less than an hour before finding him guilty of sexual assault and murder of Angela Simoda. He received a death sentence and remains on death row to this day. After Donald Bess was found guilty, Sheila knew that she needed to reach out to Russell Buchanan.
Yeah, can you imagine?
She had spent literally two decades hating this man because she thought he killed her best friend.
Yeah.
Yet he went on to live this full life. In hindsight, she was able to see that she was suspicious of everyone and it never had anything to do with Russell as a person. They ended up visiting Angela's gravesite together and she asked him for his forgiveness. He told Sheila what a relief it was to no longer carry the burden of other suspicions. Sheila initially had planned on retiring from being a private investigator after she solved Angela's case, but she decided to wait a bit after all of these people reached out for her help. She just wanted to bring justice to her best friend, and she ended up finding her calling along the way. And that is the 20-year-old cold case that was solved due to the persistence of a best friend's love.
That's incredible. Would you do that for me?
Absolutely, I would do that for you.
You would become a PI?
Oh, I mean, I would already want to do that, so.
Oh, okay.
It already sounds like an incredible career.
Yeah.
But I would absolutely do that for you. Because I know you'd do it for me. I don't even need to ask.
Hell yeah.
You'd be at the bottom of it.
Yeah, I would definitely be calling 700 times a day, not just in total.
Yeah, they'd be scared of you. And oh, I like that. They would not be scared of me.
They'd be like, ma'am, we're going to place you under arrest if you keep harassing us.
You're like, I dare you. I dare you.
I know my rights.
And that is what best friendship looks like.
Yeah, it is. Well, that is an incredible story. Thank you for telling it.
Absolutely.
All right, love you.
Love you.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorties Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/shortiespodcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anika Tharina.